You know, when Einstein predicted black holes, even he couldn't believe his math. He thought they were impossible things. There was an astrophysicist in the 60s, John Wheeler. He would give talks on black holes, and he kept calling them gravitationally completely collapsed objects. And it just got really tedious, so he started calling them black holes instead, and then caught on. Now, we can't see black holes. Wheeler says not only does it swallow anything that comes too near it, but no one lives to tell the tale. There are no footprints leading in and no footprints leading out. But we realize they exist because we see their effect. Like super bright lights, things give off as they fall into a black hole, and a strange pattern of cosmic rays as they bend around black holes. Now, the way scientists imagine black holes without seeing them is the way poets imagine how the universe came into being in creation accounts. They take the science of their time and then extrapolate an origin story of everything, like the one we have in Genesis. Have you seen the guy with the poofy hair paint on PBS? The way he dabs and layers paint here and there, and before your eyes, the smears and strokes take shape and turn into trees and leaves and cabins in the woods. This is how Genesis imagines God's creative process. Things appear in layers, and it's how David structured our psalm today. Psalm 29 is what poets called incremental repetition, like the way that guy's painting appeared in front of our eyes brush by brush and dab by dab. In verse 3 of our psalm, God's voice appears, surrounded by water, and God speaks with the power of the thunder, echoing God's voice in Genesis, speaking things into being. And then David keeps repeating this theme of God speaking and his voice moving things around by layering on into details. So in verse 4, he describes a thunderstorm rustling the trees in the forest the way they did in the cedar groves of Lebanon. This was where they sourced giant timbers for buildings and ships in David's time. One of the things on my bucket list is to go storm watching in Tofino during the fall season. I was told it rains so hard that the rains go sideways. The hotels there will lend you a raincoat so you can stroll along the beach to feel the wind and the waves, or stand among the giant cedars and listen to the rain rustle the leaves. This is exactly the experience David is describing. The forest jumping with God's creative energy, leaping like a newborn calf, he says in verse 6, the way a newborn pony struggles to stand up, it takes the first step, and then suddenly is leaping about joyfully. The next layer in verse 8 is God's voice whipping up a sandstorm in the desert of Kadesh and strips leaves from trees in an act of recreation and reshaping landscape. And then David says, nature, it's God's palace with God on his throne, regal, majestic, completely in control, making and remaking the world. These are common ancient world imagery, so much so that it's been suggested that David copied the psalm from a Canaanite original. But images it's the language of poets. Just because poets use the same alphabet doesn't mean they're copying each other's work. The main thing, of course, is that the Jewish people had very different ideas about God compared to their Canaanite neighbors. David's description of God is unlike anything in the world at that time. In ancient creation stories, water is a common image because that's what they imagined was there before the world existed, that the universe was filled with primordial water. What they call water, maybe we call that dark matter. Around the time Moses was herding the Hebrew slaves across the wilderness, towards the promised land in the Exodus story, the Babylonians were telling this creation story about how they came to be. It goes like this. The primordial world is full of water, ruled by the sea goddess Tiamat and the groundwater god Apsu. They mingled their waters together. It's a euphemism for something, you figure it out. And they had a bunch of kids. But the kids got rowdy, and mom and dad, because of the noise, can't get a decent night's sleep. So Apsu, the dad, regretted having children, and so he and his right-hand guy plotted to kill off the children. One of the kids got wind of the plot, put a spell on dad and killed him first, and then made himself the king of the universe. And he, with his wife, birthed Marduk, who is going to be the hero of the story. But while all of this was going on, Tiamat, the mom, was upset about her husband wanting to kill their kids. But she was now even more upset that they murdered her husband. So she birthed a bunch of monsters and dragons and led the gods to avenge her husband's death. War broke out. At the crucial moment, it was Tiamat in the form of a dragon against Marduk in a showdown. Marduk triumphs and slices Tiamat the dragon in half and has her watery guts spilled out. She flipped open like a book, and half of her became earth, the other half became the heavens. Marduk then made some thrones in the sky and installed his god friends as gods, and then he made some humans to serve the gods as slaves. And this is why they tell this story. See, we modern people want to know how we came to be, the process and the science of it. Ancient people were more pragmatic. They wanted to know why they came to be, for what purpose, and where they fit, so they could make sense of their lives. And what the Babylonian origin stories tell them is the reason why they feel insignificant and why their life is so hard and painful. Because they were made from dragon guts, garbage. They don't matter. And the reason their lives feel empty and exhausting is because the only reason they exist is to serve Marduk and his friends. Because the gods are all that mattered in the universe. And it's the way it is. There's nothing they could do about it. Now, compared to the Jewish creation story in Genesis 1, it also starts off very watery. Here's a very literal translation from Everett Fox. When the earth was wild and waste, darkness over the face of the ocean, rushing spirit of God hovering over the face of the waters. Can you feel it? It's dark and cold, and then the spirit shows up with a kind of low-frequency hum. There's a similar kind of wet mess, but instead of escalating into war and violence, in the chaos, we hear God's voice speaking things into existence, making order of the chaos. Let there be light, God says, and light and darkness came into being. There's day and there's night in that order. And this is the moment we start telling time, because this is the function of day and night. Again, because to ancient people, the important thing about the act of creation is not the how, but the why, the function of each thing, so they know where everything fits in the natural order of things. It's like a screw in a package of shelves from IKEA. By itself, it's nothing. But when it goes where it's supposed to, it's probably crucial to keep the shelves from falling over. The reason the Jewish God made humans was not because he needed slaves to serve him, but he wanted friends to look after creation with him, to continue creating and taking care of creation together. This is where we fit in creation. What gives our life purpose as gardeners and botanists and painters and doctors of all kinds and astrophysicists and engineers, all working together to take care of creation. You know, one day out of the blue, Eugene Peterson blurted out that he didn't care much for accountants. But I'm very grateful for mine during tax time, making order out of the chaos of all the papers and CRA forms. God made us for a relationship with him and each other, as we participate in and emulate God's creativity. Maybe this is what inspired Paul to say that the church is like a body with organs and limbs working together, that each of our identity finds a whole new level of meaning when we find our place to contribute and exercise our gifts. But I digress. Back to Genesis 1. So after ordering time, then God says, let there be a dome amid the waters. This is verse 6. Let it separate waters from waters. Because obviously, before God could start making animals and people into being, he had to make an airspace first. So God held back the waters between the outer space water and the ocean water. This air gap is where life can happen for all the humans and animals that breathe air. Genesis has the same vocabulary of water and sound and energy like the Babylonian story, but with a completely different mood. There are no angry gods fighting each other, no murder and mayhem, no dragon guts. Instead, there's a creator God creatively and powerfully speaking life into being, assigning functions to make order in the chaos. And Jewish rabbis would tell us that God didn't just create the world once, but he keeps on creating and recreating, keeps pulling people out of water and back to life. Like in the Exodus story, when God did the parting of the water thing again by holding back the water at the Red Sea, so the Hebrew slaves he rescued from Egypt could cross over into the Promised Land. He delivered the slaves back to life in a feat of recreation. And again, every time someone gets baptized, we pass through water to start life again in God's airspace. That we are alive because God is continually, untiringly holding back the waters to maintain this airspace so we can breathe and live and have our being. Every breath we take is God blowing into our nostrils, just as he blew into Adam's nostrils when he made the first human. And God continues to speak into us because the Creator God wants to be in our lives with us, among other things, to tell us the thing Jesus heard at his baptism. You are my son and daughter, chosen and marked by my love, pride of my life. That's how the message puts it. Mark Batterson wrote one of the most popular Christian books called How to Hear the Voice of God. And he writes, learning how to hear the voice of God is the key to discovering our destiny and fulfilling our potential. His voice is love. His voice is power. His voice is healing. His voice is wisdom. His voice is joy. If your life is off key, maybe it's because you've been deafened by the negative self-talk that doesn't let God get a word in edgewise. Maybe you listen to the voice of criticism so long, you can't believe anything about yourself. Or maybe it's the enemy's voice of condemnation that speaks lies about who you really are. If you don't silence those competing voices, they will eventually deafen you. The Christian God talks, not just in oracles, but very personally and intimately to the core of us, as the one who dreamed us up, designed us, and our internal wiring. There are lots of examples in the Bible when God showed up and had a conversation. But he also speaks through people and things like books and birds and thunderstorms and music and friends, anything, to get a message through to us. As the God who can find order in chaos, he comforts us, directs us in times when we need help making sense of the chaos in our lives. So it's a good thing to get to know that voice, to know when God has something to say. It might save our lives. Jesus says we should get familiar with the timbre of God's voice, the way sheep knows the shepherd's voice. Sheep are apparently not terribly smart. They're moody, and they will stupidly follow each other off a cliff. But the one thing they're good at is recognizing the shepherd's voice. There's a shepherd who talks about how when his kids were young, he gave each kid a sheep of their own to look after to prepare them for the family business. He says, each morning when a kid calls for his or her sheep, only that one comes. Wow, right? Psalm 93, it's all about finding our bearings by listening for God's voice. Whereas in the world today, we're all kind of preoccupied at listening to our own voice and more than a little skeptical that other people talking. And for good reasons, actually, because there are scammers everywhere. Someone wrote an essay, made a list of what she calls the modern revolution going on in the human soul. And at the top of her list, she has self-empowerment, positive psychology, and the voice of the common person as the new sources of wisdom. Now, I do think these are good things that help us be more aware of what is going on in ourselves and each other. All helpful things, really. After all, J.I. Packer used to say, all wisdom is God's wisdom. The trick, though, we need some way to tell if it's really wisdom that can really help us with the things we need help with, or if it's just someone pulling our leg. Like the people who want to convince us that the earth is flat, and the guy who built a rocket in his backyard so he can fly above the upper atmosphere to see for himself. The rocket exploded after takeoff and he died. The irony is that the more we just listen to ourselves, to our own kind, and limit ourselves to what we already think, the more we stop learning. Recently, a lot of people are writing books about how gullible people are becoming, because we have lost the ability to fact-check what we're being told, either by other people or by our own brains, which is especially dangerous now that computers can do deep fakes and high-tech misinformation. And it's getting very challenging to figure out what is real and what is artificial and wrong. The truth is none of us know everything. There's a lot we don't know, and there are things we don't know that we can never know unless somebody tells us. Somebody who actually knows and is trustworthy. Like this book I read recently, written by a scientist who studies fat cells. I learned things from this book that are really helping me to do healthier things. And there's no way I could have intuit the knowledge he has for me contemplating it. Just like that. There are things that we can only know because our Creator tells us. Richard Dawkins, the famous atheist, has spent his life debunking religion as something made up. But recently, he said that even though he still doesn't believe Jesus is God, he misses the good things that Jesus has done for the world. That apparently, as much as he thinks it's foolish to believe in Jesus, Jesus' teaching has been good for civilizations, he says. And because we're sidelining Jesus from our culture, we are throwing out the baby with the bathwater. So even he acknowledges that there are things Jesus taught that we cannot learn anyplace else. In fact, that blank page between the Old and the New Testament was a very chaotic time in Jewish history. All kinds of wars and power struggles and different religious factions with competing notions about God. And in that, it was out of that eye of the storm of all the unrest, that eye of the storm with all the unrest was Galilee in northern Israel. And this was where Jesus appeared, where people heard God's voice speaking again in the chaos and calling out to them. But Jesus doesn't just give us good information or be our genie to grant wishes. The best thing Jesus wants to give us is a real relationship with God. And it is out of that intimacy of our interaction with Father, Son, and Spirit that we experience recreation and resurrection. Wendell Berry, the farmer poet, writes, "It's not allowable to love creation according to the purposes one has for it, any more than it is allowable to love one's neighbor in order to borrow his tools." The new life Jesus gives us is himself, not just his tools. Because for me, as someone who does believe Jesus is God, the most important thing I hear God telling me, among all the useful things God says, is that we really matter in the universe. that we're much more than the few dollars worth of chemicals floating in a primordial mud pond when we just happened to grow legs and stood up and walked out into the world. God says he made us on purpose. As masterpieces carry his image, we have a soul that is designed to be like God, with the same creativity, the same appreciation for order and beautiful things, and the same capacity to love and be loved. And because we matter so much to God, God doesn't want our lives to end in death. But instead, God went to all lengths to find a way to gift us with resurrection so we can live with him in eternity. But resurrection is not just the thing that happens after we die. It's the process of recreation that begins the moment we enter into relationship with God, as we become adopted as a child into his family, as it were. Because instead of us making it up as we go along in life on our own, with our limited control and knowledge and perspective, God wants to become involved in our lives to coach us and to empower us to live larger than we can on our own. Which brings us to why I think David wrote this poem. In our English Bible, verse 1 begins with the word ascribe, which means give. It's repeated 3 times. So David starts with give to the Lord glory and strength, and then he ends in verse 11 with asking God to give strength and peace to his people. Psalm 93 ends as a prayer for strength and peace. To my ear, I detect some urgency, that this may not be a sunny day song. But David asks for strength and peace because there's a threat to their well-being. So all the stuff in the middle about God's powerful voice is not just some frivolous ode to the Creator, sentimental gush about his voice speaking life into being, but it's begging for help, a confession to how we need God for our very existence, because something scary is afoot. And we need that same voice to speak life into us. And as David prays for urgent help, he's reminding himself to whom he's praying. He's reviewing what God is like. The God whom he believes is listening to this prayer, the timbre of that voice he's waiting on to speak. So what are you praying for at this moment in your life? Is it sunny days for you? Or is there something at stake, under threat? You know, in Japanese shrines, there's always somewhere a setup, a place where people can write down and hang a prayer. It could be paper rolled up and knotted on a tree, or a little wooden tile on a lattice wall. I was quite moved by these prayer trees and walls. Thousands of prayers, you can see. And people of all ages, kids in school uniforms standing around writing down their prayers, people going through heavy things, reaching out to the universe, asking for help. And just looking at all of that, I feel their pain. I also wonder who they thought was listening to those prayers. The first couple I ever married as a pastor, when they had a baby, I walked over to the hospital with some food for the husband. I wasn't planning to stay long, just drop the food off and go to the office. When I got there, I found the dad holding the 2-day-old baby pacing in the hallway in front of the room. He was trying to give his wife a break so she could get a nap in. He had this look on his face that looked desperate for some adult company. When he saw me, he held out the baby and said, "Hey, do you want to hold him?" Now, actually, not really. But then I wanted to be polite, so I accepted the baby. We sat down on the couch outside the room. I laid the baby on my chest, and he went back to sleep. We sat there like that for almost 3 hours, I think. The baby just sleeping as his dad and I carried on a conversation talking about this and that. Now, one day, a few years later, I noticed every time this little boy waddled by me in church, if I was talking to somebody, he would just stop and crane his neck to scan around with this puzzled look on his face, like trying to figure out where he heard that voice before. Now, I don't know if this is true, but wouldn't it be hilarious if over those 3 hours on the second day of his life on earth, when he slept on my chest, that somehow my voice got imprinted into his soul? How fun would that be? What if we have an imprinting of God's voice in our soul? Part of being made by God in his image, and he's always saying something to us. We just need to be open and listen for that voice that could very well be speaking life into us, the life we need at the moment. If there's something you want to hear from God, ask God to speak and make space to listen, and maybe you'll come back with a story. Take a moment and begin a conversation with God, and I got some Malcolm guide for you. Call us, O Christ, and open up the gate. Call us to worship with your mighty voice, the voice that sings through rivers in full spate, the voice in which the forests all rejoice, the voice that rolls through thunder clouds and calls the deep sea and steep waves, the quiet voice that stirs our sleeping conscience and recalls us to the love we had abandoned, leads us through the parting mists of doubt, or falls upon us like a revelation, pleads with us upon the poor's behalf, blazes in glory with each burning bush, and bleeds out from compassion's wounds, the voice that raises our drooping spirits till we dance for joy, and gives us too a voice to sing his praises. Amen.